You're listening to The Bill Murphy Show, the music interview show featuring the best in the business. From behind the scenes, in the studio, and on the stage. Available by subscription for free on iTunes and at BillMurphyShow.com. And now, here's your host, Bill Murphy.
And now, here's your new digital broadcast for this Wednesday, January 25th, 2012. It's actually the next day for my guest, but we'll get to that in a moment. Brought to you, as usual, by Lulu's Bait Shack. Great live music, fresh Florida seafood, and those famous, gigantic fishbowl drinks, all at Lulu's on A1A in the heart of Fort Lauderdale Beach in Beach Place. And by Satchmo, the great new live location there on Commercial Boulevard between Bayview and US 1. I want to remind you of their lineup coming on this weekend. The Pat DeLeon Trio on Friday night. Blues Dragon on the Road to Memphis show. And it's also a special fundraiser. That's happening Saturday night, the 28th, at Satchmo. And then on Monday, the 30th, my longtime radio buddy, Stu Grant, hosts and presents the Big Band Night with the Bobby Rodriguez Jazz Orchestra. That's all going on at Satchmo there on Commercial Boulevard. Just pretty much Commercial Boulevard and Bayview Drive in Fort Lauderdale. That, of course, is for all you local folks listening in the South Florida area, or for those of you who plan on being in the area over the weekend. But we reach overseas for this show. Very special visit to Cairo, Egypt for this show. Yeah, I can safely say this is our first interview from Egypt, and an exciting one it is. And if you've listened to the archives of the show and kind of browsed through some of the guests we've had on, you know, I like this stuff that's out of the ordinary and different. And this is definitely no exception as we bring you Dreamful of Zen. And Dave joins me. You know, he's known as Dreamful of Zen. He's the brains, the man, the inventor, the creator of all of this music. And I'm assuming the producer and engineer of all of it as well. And he joins me from Cairo, Egypt. I guess it is the next day, right? Are we talking early in the morning at this point?
We are 7 minutes past midnight, my good man. So it is the next day, as it were.
Oh, okay. So just barely the next day. And just for reference, indeed, so folks know, we are recording this 5 p.m. Eastern time here in South Florida in the United States. So we talk on via Skype with a 7-hour time delay and learn about this great new project. We'll tell you a little bit about Dreamful of Zen. It features some very different sounding stuff, including the double reeded instrument Duduk. Great guitar work. The new album is called 2035. It is Dreamful of Zen's fourth solo album. And we're going to get into a lot of it, including the artwork, the production behind it, and the inspiration behind all of this music. First of all, let's get right to the important stuff. 2035 is, as you told me before we started recording, on the verge of being released. There's no solid release date. And I, these days everything sort of varies because there's so many different avenues to get the music out. People can still get a hold of it, although there's not an official release date per se. Am I getting that right?
Indeed. I mean, that's the danger of being an independent musician. You know, you just have to roll the, you know, just put it out there and it gets done when it gets done, you know.
Right. But people can find you at dreamfulofzen.net and actually at least listen to some samples of that and download some stuff if they look hard enough on the site, correct?
And indeed they can, and they can keep up to date with all the lovely social media stuff all scared about.
Now, I want to get to some of this music as soon as possible so people can hear the music that we're going to be referring to during this interview. Let me go ahead while we're talking. Let me go ahead and roll a little bit of this, not to be disrespectful to the music, but the title track, as it were, called 2035 here is a real short piece, and we can kind of roll it underneath us while we're talking about it. Let's just listen to a couple of moments of this here so people can get an idea of what it sounds like. Now, to say that this music is very global sounding is an understatement. It's very dreamscapey, soundscapey and ambient and moody, I guess would be just a few words you could use to describe this type of music. If you had to, and I know people hate being pigeonholed into a genre, if you had to say what kind of genre it is, what category would you try to put your music into?
Ooh, that's
it's a tough one question, for this kind of music, yeah.
I think the closest category I could fit it in, someone pointed out to me that my music is very soundtrack, like, you know, it would really work in a film or something, I guess, or and maybe a video game.
And it in fact has, when we'll get to that as well, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think the category will be once it's listed on iTunes and available there? I mean, they've got basically hundreds of genres listed there. I think you're the one that decides that when you post it. So what categories would you use when you're posting it on iTunes, for example?
Well, the problem is they kind of limit you to, I think it's like 10 or 12 kind of bass categories. And unfortunately, I think I get lumped into instrumental, which is probably the least commercially viable, you know, category there is these days. So.
But yet sometimes the most artistic as well, which is the way it goes, right?
Well, yeah, it's a catch-22, isn't it?
Now, absolutely. Now, ambient would be, you know, accurate and would apply, I'm sure, to some degree. How did you get into being an instrumental music artist? What was the first? Let's start with your beginnings and how you got into music and what your earliest influences were. If you listen back, if you think back to when you were a kid, the very first things you were listening to and being turned on by, what artists would we be talking about?
It's the typical kind of British thing. I mean, I kind of grew up listening to guys like Queen, Def Leppard, you know, just the stuff that was on the radio at the time, really.
Right.
You know, and then that kind of progressed into the kind of the more American stuff. So, you know, Guns N' Roses, Journey, Toto, you know, just the good stuff, really.
Right. And what guitar would have been the first instrument you got your hands on as a young boy?
Unfortunately, no. I mean, my father tried to get me to try different instruments, and, you know, it was the keyboard, and like I said, I had no musical ability whatsoever. So, And embarrassing enough, he even actually got me an accordion. I was playing an accordion for a while as well.
Well, you know, it requires a great deal of skill to play the accordion, so that's nothing to be ashamed of there.
It's not very rock, is it, you know?
No, not really, but this type of music, though, it really is kind of music that makes you think. And again, we're going to get into playing a whole track here shortly so people can vibe to it and kind of get into the headspace that you've created with this thing. But how did you, I don't know, let's talk about how you developed into making this kind of music. Are you a technical type of guy that felt like I'm assuming you're putting it all together yourself and doing all the production yourself as well. Was that part of it? Was it experimenting with sounds? What were the things that led you to, you know, kind of falling into this category, as it were?
I think what really happened was when I was about 16, 17, and I went to college, and I was doing this kind of this music technology, you know, I kind of raised my eyebrow at that, but they kind of sat us down in front of a computer, and you had at the time the state-of-the-art kind of sequencer, MIDI sequencer kind of software, which is, you know, kind of collecting dust now, I guess, but you know, it was just, the problem is, you know, all that stuff is really made for keyboardists, you know, so here's this guitar player sitting down in front of this software.
Right.
Without a clue what to do. So it kind of started there, I think.
Now, in particular, would we be talking about Reason or Ableton Live, that type of stuff?
Well, like, you know, decades before that, I'm talking about like Cubase. Cubase VST, as it was named back in, I think, what was it, 98, 99?
Way back in 98, 99, right?
Yeah.
And so, as I've experienced myself, that kind of software, as you're learning it and experimenting with it, it can in itself sort of dictate and influence a little bit and help with the creativity part of it. I assume that that's part of your creative process as well, as being influenced by the sounds themselves.
It's partially. I mean, the thing that caused me to see, the thing is, most guitar players are used to writing on their guitar. You know, you pick up the guitar and you bash out a few chords, and hey, you've got a song.
Sure.
Whereas with this whole approach of the sequencer, I had a computer in front of me and a keyboard, which is an instrument which is not really familiar to me, and you know, I had to try and figure out to make music on the thing. So.
Right.
It was kind of completely unnatural, and I think I kind of took a completely different approach, and that kind of ended up shaping how I guess I thought about writing music.
I got a little bit onto your website and read a little bit about the gear that you work with. You work with ESP guitars. Is that primarily the brand of guitar you use across the board?
Pretty much. I mean, you know, I've played pretty much all the brands that there are out there, and ESP just kind of always felt like home, you know?
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Queen briefly. I think I can hear some of the Brian May influence you've had. I mean, I think Brian May sometimes isn't really up high enough on the lists of guitar heroes that he should be, you know, matched with the greats of the world. I mean, you agree Brian May is one of the all-time greats one of the most innovative guitar players we've ever heard.
Oh yeah, I mean that's the thing about these guys. You know, you think, oh, Brian May, you know, yeah, he played guitar in Queen. Well, yeah, but he did so much, and he wrote a lot of the tunes. And yeah, the thing is, it happens all the time. I mean, just, you know, just look at Neil Sean, or just look at Steve Lukather. You know,
sure.
You know, people are like arguing on forums. You know, who's the better than, you know, Kirk Hammett versus blah blah blah, and it's like, oh god, you know.
You know, I see England, you know, when I look at and again, this is just the conversation that we're having here has kind of just led me to ask you this question, because it's just occurring to me now. I've looked at many, many polls over the years, and it seems to me, you know, judging by the polls that I read out of the UK and the lists and the rankings of guitar players, England's music fans, and you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, seem to be way like one of the most highly critical groups of people out there. They are really, really into ranking and voting and deciding who's better. And you said there's people discussing things like this on forums all the time. Can you, as far as guitar player fans go, are the UK fans the most critical that there are out there? That's the idea I get.
Oh, I mean, they're terrible. You know, I mean, I mean that in a good way, of course.
But, right.
It's just. The problem is, it's become this thing where, like, a lot of these young guys can actually play really well. So, you know, they'll look at these kind of older guys and be like, oh man, that's nothing special. I can play that, you know.
Sure.
And then they kind of miss the point. It's like, well, yeah, you can play it, but you didn't really come up with it. So.
Right, and they latch onto their heroes and hang on to them. And if anybody dares to imitate them, I mean, they're gonna face a wrath of criticism from those British fans. You know, that's just the idea I get.
You know, they're going to come after you with their Doc Martin boots, you know.
Right, exactly. All right, so 2035 is this exciting new record from Dreamful of Zen. And the opening track on here is a track called Equilibrium. I know this has got to be, when someone is so, all-encompassing as far as the writing, the production, and the whole kind of, what's the word I'm looking for? The whole image and the overall packaging of a project like this. Was it a tough decision to come up with which tune should open the record? It sounds to me, from the sound of this, that you did pick the right one. But how did you go about deciding that Equilibrium would be the opening number on this track? And tell me, if you can, what the creative influence was behind making this song.
Well, I mean, the thing is with Equilibrium, it was actually the first track that I wrote for 2035 back in 2005, I think it was.
Okay.
And it's funny because I'd wanted to do something electronic and heavy and Middle Eastern and blah, 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 and I could never really pull it off. And it was just this one night, it just kind of came to me. I just sat there and I kind of wrote the kind of skeleton kind of shape of the track, and you know, before I knew it, it was like, hey, I've got something here, you know.
Huh, interesting. It seems like you've answered both questions with that one explanation because, you know, in one hand, you took the track that you've had the longest, that you had been working on the longest, that you created way back then, and then also it just sort of represented sort of all of those genres and those dynamics that you described all in one tune. So I guess it makes it all the more appropriate to be the opening track.
Well, it's the funny thing as well, you know, the actual title, Equilibrium. I mean, when I first wrote the track, I called it 2035. I had no idea what to call it. And then towards the end, when I'd put all these kind of different instruments and all the layers, it just kind of made sense to really call it kind of Equilibrium, you know.
All right, well, let's everybody check it out here. It's called Equilibrium. It's from the brand new 2035 project, Dreamful of Zen, on the Bill Murphy Show. Equilibrium very, very descriptive opening track from his great new album, 2035, Dreamful of Zen. Dave Tofik on the phone with me from Cairo, Egypt, discussing this this music. That really kind of puts it all together. It represents pretty much everything that you're about to hear, or sort of gives you a great introduction to everything you're going to hear on 2035. And so full and so, you know, so much instrumental there. There's Middle Eastern aspects there. There's rock guitar riffs and licks in there. There's great orchestral sounding instrumentation in there. And do we get to hear a little bit of the duduk, this interesting woodwind instrument that you also play? That's in there somewhere as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like in the first kind of part.
Right, as it leads in there.
Yeah.
For those of us who don't know what the duduk is, then that would include myself. Give me a little bit about what that instrument's all about, and I think when you describe it and tell us what it is, people will realize that they've heard it without even realizing they have heard it before.
Yeah, I mean, it's this crazy instrument it's been all over the place, and it's got this kind of knack for being mistaken for other things. I mean, you know, sometimes you hear anything, is that a person singing, is that some kind of violin, you know, what the hell is that, you know? And it's just been on pretty much every other, you know, Hollywood kind of blockbuster over the last, I don't know, 15 years maybe.
Right, you said it was part of the soundtrack of The Crow, in fact.
Well, I mean, it's famously known for being in the Gladiator soundtrack.
Oh, okay.
But, I think it was last year, I was just sitting there watching The Crow, and, you know, I'm sitting there, and the movie starts, well, hang on, that's a duduk.
Wow.
You know, I saw this film 12, 13 years ago, and I didn't realize it, you know.
And what would its origin be? Where did that instrument get created, in what country, what part of the world, do you know?
It's a sensitive subject.
Really?
As far as I know, it's Armenian, but the problem is, you know, just for saying that, I could get probably beaten up by a Turkish person or an Azerbaijani kind of person, because, you know, they all take claim to having, you know, built this instrument. So,
well, we'll be politically correct and leave that one alone then. And I guess that,
well, let's just say the one I play is Armenian, and leave it at that, you know.
All right, cool. Which kind of leads me into my next question. You were born and raised in the UK, correct?
Indeed.
And you are a very, very schooled musician. In fact, you have a degree. You're one of those guys that, I was talking to Andy Timmons recently, who was one of those very, very studious musicians who just didn't one of those kids that just, you know, sat on the edge of his bed learning stuff by ear. I'm sure he did a great deal of that as well, but he did, you know, painstakingly take courses and learn and get all the theory down. You did a lot of that as well. And that happened in the UK too?
It happened indeed in the UK, yes. At ACM, the Academy of Contemporary Popular Music, as it were.
Wow. And so, did you find overall that was a worthwhile experience for you? How much did it expand your musical horizons?
It was really invaluable. I mean, walking in there, I already had pretty much a load of chops and theory. But like most, you know, guys at that age who kind of think they're, you know, good players, you know, you get kind of thrown in the deep end and you realize just what it means to be a, you know, working professional, you know.
Mm-hmm. Now, and that sort of leads me, you were speaking to you now, you're in Cairo, Egypt, so tell us if you can, how your experiences and your whole life evolved into getting you into Cairo, Egypt. What's the tie-in, and how did you end up where you are now from the UK?
Well, you see, the problem is in the UK, the music scene there is pretty much kind of lopsided. As a guitar player, you could pretty much forget about making a living. Whereas, you know, if you're a DJ, then, you know, you're all set. So, you know, I had to kind of find a career for myself while I was kind of finishing up at ACM. And I was really interested in doing film music, you know, music for media. And I'd noticed that more and more and gradually, you know, there was this kind of Middle Eastern influence on kind of these Hollywood scores. I said, you know, it would really give me quite an edge over a lot of these people if I actually knew something about this kind of music.
Wow. And as much as your upbringing and then your education in the UK at the ACM and all that, as much as that expanded your horizons, I would imagine ending up in a part of the world like Egypt would have even just taken all of that to another higher level, right?
Well, it's just jaw-dropping. You know, you kind of think, you know a lot about music, and then you realize you know a lot about music from one perspective, and unfortunately it's a very small perspective. You know, Western music compared to I'm reluctant to say world music, but music of the other regions of the world, as it were. You know, it's mind-blowing. You know.
Yeah, take us a little bit into that, because on the most pedestrian level, when Americans, and I guess, I don't speak for all Americans, but I think generally speaking, we hear Middle Eastern music, and for lack of a better term, it doesn't make much sense to us on the surface. It sounds very dissonant and very droney at times. But when you get into it and really get into the gist of that music, what's going on there that we're not immediately recognizing? And when it comes down to it, the things that you really appreciate about that music, I think you know what I'm trying to ask you here. Can we get into it in detail?
Yeah, sure, man. I mean, like you said, to most of us, when you hear these kind of melodies, it's like, that sounds off. There's, I can't hum that. I can't sing that. That's not really, what I'm used to.
Right.
And, the funny thing is, I mean, it seems weird to us, but the irony is that, that stuff is old, and pretty much, the olden kind of Western music did actually have that kind of dissonance to it. It's just over the years, it kind of got phased out, if you will. Mm-hmm. So it's inherently in all of us to be able to hear that stuff and appreciate it. And I think that is kind of the appeal to some of us when we hear it. It seems familiar, if you will, I'm reluctant to say like a past life or something, but it feels like there's just something very genuinely kind of, hereditary about it,
Wow. So it really, really pulled you in a very almost spiritual kind of way.
Well, I mean, the thing is, I'm like the majority of guitar players, I'm kind of inclined to believe that pretty much every great kind of melody has been more or less written. It's really hard to come up with something that can really grab people's attention. And when it comes to that kind of, the thing is with Eastern music in particular, there's no real harmony. But in terms of the melody, just the melodic possibilities are just endless.
Sure. Yeah, and it, when it comes right down to it, there's more notes in the scales in Eastern music than there is in the traditional Western music that most of us are familiar with. Would that be correct if I said that?
It's very correct. I mean, the most basic form is, I think, 17 notes as opposed to the 12 notes of the Western, but it can actually go all the way up to, I think, to 36. So.
Wow. So the semitones that we're used to and the sense that we tune into when we try to fine-tune a note are actual notes when it comes right down to it in Eastern music, which is fascinating to me.
Well, the scary thing is, not only are they notes, but if they're played in certain contexts, they evoke a certain kind of mood or meaning. And, when you start looking at it from an analytical point of view, it just becomes daunting. It's like, how the hell am I supposed to study and learn that?
Wow.
But that's the Western mind, For the Eastern mind, they just hear it and they feel it,
Yeah. Oh, wow. You went exactly where I wanted you to go with that answer. It's amazing to me how not only do I have so much fun with this show and get to talk to such a wide variety of people, but it seems like I learn something new every day on this show. And every time I think I know a lot about music, it's guys like you that sort of set me straight on things. There's a couple of things about this. First of all, I want to acknowledge Keith Medley, who was a guest I had back in the late 2011, who was from Nashville and played that fascinating 27-string guitar that he built himself. And you told me earlier before we started taping that you had contacted Keith, and he's the one who turned you onto the show. So I appreciate Keith bringing you to the Bill Murphy Show family. And hats off, Keith, and I hope all is well with you, my friend. And I want to get into this self-production aspect and also another thing. So I guess I can ask you these two questions at the same time. And see where you go with it. I am assuming, since you told me you have a lot of gear and you do a lot of the production and you were in, you know, familiar with the MIDI software that created a lot of these compositions that you have, how do you step outside of yourself and listen to yourself objectively when you go to produce this? How do you fight off the temptation to have somebody else mix it and bring another set of ears to the project? And then also, how do you translate this to the stage? When you go out and perform, what form of this music do we hear, and how do you present it? Is it solo? Is it with a band or otherwise?
Sure, yeah. I mean, the thing is, you know, I really hate the idea of getting someone to do work for me and not paying them, you know. So the idea of kind of hiring an engineer and a mastering engineer is just, I would love to do that, but I don't have 15 to 20 grand to blow on that, you know. So
right.
I just have to handle that myself. And I'll be honest with you, I hate doing it because it's kind of like you develop like this split personality, because the guitar player wants everything to sound huge. And the sound engineer, you know, is the voice of reason, says, well, no, everything can't sound huge. And it's kind of like I'm arguing with myself, if you will, you know.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's really crazy, you know. I mean, thank God no one actually watches me do this stuff, because they would have put me in a straitjacket by now, you know.
I can relate to that myself, because I know how difficult it is. I mean, even doing voice work, for that matter, to sit back and equalize something and mix it. You want to put yourself in the shoes and use the ears of the client or the listener that you're doing it for, as opposed to yourself. Because I think even people that aren't musicians can relate to hearing your own voice on a tape recorder for the first time and going, ew, that's not what I sound like. I mean, that whole dynamic never really goes away, does it?
It doesn't. I mean, that's the thing, man. I mean, like, I will do a take. And I'll be like, no, that sucks. And then I'll do another take, and then another take. And then usually I'll just leave them, because I know I'm driving myself insane. And
right.
I'll come back the next day and I'll listen to them with fresh ears and be like, man, what the hell was I doing? The first take was fine. Why don't I waste 2 hours doing 50 takes? You know, it's just, uh-huh, just stupid.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to know that I'm not alone in that aspect. I know one night to the next or one day to the next, I can think something sounds completely awful and then listen to it, you know, the next morning and go, what was I thinking? It sounds great. Yeah, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's crazy, man. It's crazy.
And then so live, performing this stuff, how do you go about that? And when we see your music performed live, how do we see it?
See, this has been a really huge issue for me, because whenever I sit down and write this stuff, I always say to myself, you know, Dave, you need to sit down and write this in a format that you can play it live. But if I'm going to do that, that means I'm just going to write, you know, drums, bass, and guitar. And that, to me, it's just, you know, I wish I was one of these guitar players that could pull that off, you know, like guys like Andy Timmons, you know, and Steve Lukather, they can pull it off, you know, blindfolded. I can't really do that. So I need to do something when I'm writing, just to make the music more interesting. And the problem is, when I do that, I end up putting about 20 bloody, you know, different instruments in there. It's like, well, how am I supposed to perform this live?
Right.
So, so far it's just been, I kind of do like a clinic thing where I'll just kind of play over a backing track, and then I'll interact with the audience, you know, just questions. Do you want to ask me, how do I do this? How do I do that? That kind of thing, you know.
Oh, cool. So it's more or less a very interactive experience for the people.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to get up and do guitar karaoke, if you know what I mean. It's like, you know, if I'm just going to get up and play and then walk off, I mean, the audience didn't really get much out of it. So I try and make it as interesting as possible,
and and as organic as possible. We're talking to Dreamful of Zen. We're talking to Dave and Dave Tofik. Is that how we pronounce your last name? Am I doing that correctly?
No, you're saying it right. I mean, here they pronounce it very differently, but you are nailing it, my friend.
I'm Americanizing it, right?
And, well, you know,
and this is fantastic. 2035 is the new project. I want to listen to one more track, but first, before I do, the artwork on this thing, both on your website, on the cover itself. I know it's such a shame these days. It's one of the, there are so many good things and so many bad things about the digital age. Of course, the good things is the accessibility and the ease of downloading and getting something instantly in your hands and into your ears. But the bad part is that whole aspect of holding on to a record project, opening it up and seeing the great artwork, it's kind of slipped away. But you still include some fantastic artwork in there. I'm just guessing. I have no idea. You haven't told me yes or no on this, and we've never spoken about it. Is that your work, the artwork that we see on the cover of 2035?
It is indeed.
Wow. I don't know. I don't know why I knew that. It just seemed to reflect the same personality as the music. So I guess that's why I made that guess. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that's like I said, that it's funny because that's kind of what sparked the music off for 2035 in the first place. I was kind of just experimenting, kind of teaching myself how to use these 3D kind of rendering programs. And I just kind of noodled around, made this one quick picture, and that kind of sparked off the itch to write Equilibrium, as it were.
Huh.
So just over the years of just getting to use it and know it, that's, you know, like I said, I would have loved to actually hire like a really good talented artist to do my, you know, artwork, but like I said, can't afford it, so just had to do it myself.
Well, you know, I guess it's great because it's another, it's just another added dimension of your personality and the idea that you're trying to get across in the project. So I think it works just as good, just as well, that it is your music. Now I look at the artwork and I listen to the music, and I of course I see the title 2035, and I assume that we're talking about a concept or a feeling of something that happens in the future. So I guess it seems inevitable that this could lead into something more. You mentioned a little bit about being a comic artist and maybe getting into doing some comic series. And this could become an animated film. Could there be an animated film version of 2035 in the future if things go well?
Well, I mean, it started off as a very badly written movie script, you know, and it just kind of digressed, if you know, into the just lower brow formats, and until it reached comic format, as it were.
Right.
You know, and I mean, the problem is these days it's very hard to make a living as an instrumental guitar player. You know, my name's not Steve Vai or Joe Satriani, so I don't sell hundreds of records. So
right.
I had to find something else to make ends meet, and a comic and, you know, tying it into the music just kind of seemed to make sense.
An all-encompassing creative individual, and it's great. And you're also very humble. You're not giving yourself enough credit about your musicianship, my friend. Desert God is the next track we're going to listen to here. Tell us a little bit about Desert God before we listen. And I'm sure once I listen to this 4 minutes and 20 seconds of this, that I'll have more to ask you about it. But where did the influence from this track come from?
Honestly, it was last year. It was actually during the first couple of weeks of January when all the craziness was going on here in Cairo with the revolution and whatnot. And I wanted to write something kind of in that kind of just guitar, bass, drums kind of vein, not too many instruments. And it was just during those couple of weeks that it kind of came to me, I guess.
And here it is, Desert God from 2035, Dream Full of Zen on The Bill Murphy Show. Get those headphones out, folks.
Thank you.
Desert God from 2035, Dreamful of Zen, on an international Bill Murphy show as we talk to Dave from Dreamful of Zen all the way from Cairo, Egypt via Skype. It's been a pleasure. I've made a new friend, and my musical horizons have been even more expanded as they seem to be continuously on this show. I really appreciate you coming on and sharing this stuff with me.
Well, thanks for having me, man. It's all good.
People can find you by just typing in Dreamful of Zen in one word anywhere on Facebook. Actually, dreamfulofzen.net. You can find it there on Facebook that way. There's going to be, you can Google and get to YouTube and type that in there. You can see some instructional stuff. I noticed that you you get into teaching scales and stuff on YouTube videos as well. So it's very cool. It must be very rewarding to share some styles and methods of playing guitar via YouTube as well, is it not?
It's funny because, you know, back in the day when I was learning to play and, you know, the internet was this crazy new thing, you know, that you plug into your telephone. We didn't have things like YouTube, you know, we had
right.
like forums and stuff. So, you know, it's just, it's incredible, you know, the stuff that you can kind of just get off the amount of free information, you know.
Well, I would imagine being the youngster that you are, you probably did learn a great deal of stuff from YouTube as well, probably even recently. And it seems to me like you're doing a little bit of paying back by doing this and sharing some of your methods and styles and skills with people as well.
Well, you know, if I can save anyone, you know, the years of confusion and head scratching that I had to go through, I'm happy to do it, you know.
I got to admit, I'm not much of a guitar player. You know, I'm a singer. I tool around with guitar and piano a little bit, but I don't consider myself to be skilled on either one of them. But I must say, while I was watching one of your videos, it is very clearly laid out. It was these three notes per string scales that you were looking at. And I, for the first time over many, many years of watching this, I went, wow, I think if I really sat down and concentrated, I might be able to do that. I not quite as fast as you were doing it the fourth or fifth time around, but you know, it seemed like it was very simply laid out and makes it easy to follow along. So if anybody wants to learn some of that amazing guitar work that you heard on Desert God and Equilibrium there, you can check out Dreamful of Zen on YouTube. So there you go, folks. A number of different avenues for you to experience more of Dreamful of Zen. Of course, find them on iTunes probably in a matter of the next few days, right? Not listed on there yet?
No, well, fingers crossed.
Right, okay. Yeah, I know how painful and painstaking that whole method, that whole process can be, but once it's up there, it's amazing how easy it is for you to share it with the rest of the world. And we appreciate you sharing your stuff on the Bill Murphy Show once again, my brother.
Well, it's like I said, man, it's nice to just, you know, get some love, as it were.
You know? Well, you got plenty of it here, and hopefully I'll do my part in spreading the word of Dreamful of Zen to our listeners all around the world. Hang on for just a second there, Dave, so we can say goodbye. Let me wrap things up here. Once again, sure. Thanks again for joining me, my man.
Thank you for having me.
Check us out. More new shows coming up. In fact, many, many of them booked in the next few days. So before the end of the year here in the next 5 days, we should have three or four new shows up for you. And then it will continue on into February, of course. Like Keith Medley did, if you have any artists that you'd like to turn me on to, contact me at murph@billmurphyshow.com and let me know who I should be aware of and have on the show. And keep checking us out at billmurphyshow.com.
Subscribe to the Bill Murphy Show podcast for free at iTunes. You can post comments about today's show, listen to archived episodes, and like the show on Facebook by visiting BillMurphyShow.com. A presentation of Bill Murphy Productions.